This talk was recorded by Insight Meditation South Bay in Mountain View, California. For more talks and information, visit www.imsb.org.
I was really sorry to hear that Paul couldn't be with you tonight. Paul's a dear friend of mine, and he's had some recent illnesses, and certainly I was happy to come in his place. Before we begin, I just want to say a couple of things. One is, I want you to think about these age-old problems of fear, anxiety, attachment, and delusion, because in many ways these are the barriers for an individual to be compassionate. And then the things that stimulate compassion, of course, which we'll talk about, are bonding, nurturing, caring, and community. I want to tell you two stories before I start. I was with a gentleman, and periodically I go to Aspen because people ask me to come there. We were in this mansion that must have been $30 or $40, $50 million mansion, and a very wealthy man. And he comes to me and he says, "You know, my life has been filled with misery," and he's almost 80. Now, before we get to that part of the subject, he says, "You know, see this watch? This watch is worth $250,000. It's the only one that there is in the world." He says, "I have to show you my garage." He says, "There's over $5 million worth of cars in this garage." Now, I've just met this man. We walk into the entry to the home, and there's a life-size painting of him. Now, you're already probably getting a sense why he might be miserable. And he says to me, he says, "I would do anything for happiness." And I said, "Well, I can give that to you." He says, "How would you do that?" And I said, I tell you, if you spend an hour with me every day, just you and I, for 10 sessions, I will completely change your life and make you happy and give you that thing you say you want so badly." And here's his first question. Does anybody know what it is? That's exactly right. So I say, "It'll cost you $100,000 a session." And he looks at me and he goes, "How about 50? And then he says to me, and his daughter's actually there, and she's listening to this, and he says, "Well, you know, I really can't pay that." Now, this is a man who's worth close to $1 billion. He says, "I really can't pay that because I have to take care of my children." Okay. And his daughter looks at him and says, "You know, Dad," or it's his grandfather, "I have to take care of my grandchildren." She says, "Grandpa, if this would make you happy, I would be happy to receive nothing." Now, can you imagine this? And he says, "Well, I'll consider doing it, but I want a money-back guarantee." I mean, could you imagine an actual conversation like that? The other story is Eckhart Tolle and I were together the other day, and Eckhart and I were chatting about some of these issues. And what is the barrier, again, that stops us from actually not talking about being compassionate, but actually being compassionate? And we were sitting chatting, and he gave this interesting example of this meditator who had been years and years of meditation. And he was sitting in his room, and he's got his, you know, he's sitting down like this deep meditation. He was doing this very involved loving-kindness meditation. And his child walks in the door unexpectedly, and he turns to him and says, "What the hell are you doing interrupting my loving-kindness meditation?" Ladies and gentlemen, the understanding on a cognitive or intuitive level of compassion is far different from incorporating compassion as an ethos of your life. And this is something to really think about. You know, they did an interesting study, and it was of seminarians. And what they did was they put a time constraint on them, and they had to walk a distance to the chapel to give their sermon. And these are individuals who are about to graduate. and they gave them a very short period of time to prepare this sermon, which was to be about the Good Samaritan. So the distance to the chapel was maybe 100 yards. And what they did was they placed a man on the ground, laid on his side, moaning. And how many people do you think stopped to help this man? Very, very few. And again, it gets back to this same point. Compassion is not something that you carry in your head, and you somehow think that if you carry it in your head, that makes you a compassionate person. It doesn't. Walking around telling people how much time you spend meditating on compassion doesn't make you a compassionate person. Opening your heart to the suffering of others and engaging in that suffering is what makes you. I'm sorry I have a cold, which I'm recovering from, but I don't think I'm infectious. This is a picture of my son. He had the wonderful joy of spending time with His Holiness when he visited Stanford. And it's interesting because we talk about science, and it's extraordinary, people like His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, and other people who have spent great time inside themselves and also looking at the world, make comments that science ends up showing are in fact true. And in fact, this statement here, if you want others to be happy, practice compassion. If you wish to be happy, practice compassion. And fundamentally, in a nutshell, that's what we're going to talk about, and that's what science proves. So this is our topic tonight. And compassion, at least in terms of scientific definition, is the recognition of another's suffering with a desire to alleviate that suffering. The center at Stanford, as was mentioned, His Holiness the Dalai Lama was the founding benefactor of that center. I had begun some initial explorations into this area. As you probably heard, I'm a professor of neurosurgery, and I'm sure all the neurosurgeons you know are the most compassionate, engaging individuals you've ever met. And they're very humble people, usually. I'm not quite sure what happened to me on the way to the neurosurgery door, but this idea of compassion has been with me since I was a child. You know, I recall as a child being in situations, and I grew up in poverty. My family was on public assistance. Neither of my parents went to college. My mother was an invalid. My father was an alcoholic. And I used to be in these situations where I would see people of means, of influence, significant amounts of money, who would see people suffering and would completely ignore them. And I'm not talking about just myself, but other situations. And I would sit there and I would just be astounded. And then you would see people who have nothing but give everything. And you sit there, you say, why is there this paradox? Why on the one hand the people who seemingly have everything hold so tightly to it, and the people who seemingly have very little just give it away? And in fact, oftentimes the people who are in that position, when we talked about the gentleman earlier, he's miserable. His whole life has been one of misery, and he's acquired, and he's acquired, and he's acquired, and he's still empty. You know, isn't it a paradox that we have all of these people from the third world who want to come to the U.S.? Isn't that extraordinary? Where we have the greatest epidemic of isolation, loneliness, and despair. One quarter of people say that they feel that they have no one to talk to or share their pain with when they're suffering in the United States. Can you imagine? Yet people from cultures which have some of the richest wisdom traditions want to come here where we have rampant, conspicuous consumption. The United States consumes 25% of the world's resources, yet we're miserable. I mean, it's, again, an extraordinary paradox. But the founding of the center, getting back to that before I head off into this philosophy, I had started these explorations. I had left Stanford and done some entrepreneurial things and had come back. And I engaged some of my colleagues, psychology and neuroscience, to do some preliminary explorations on this issue of compassion. We did those. I said, wouldn't it be amazing if His Holiness came back to Stanford and gave a talk on compassion? This led to an introduction to His Holiness at our very first meeting. He and I chatted for a while. And he immediately agreed to come back to Stanford. He had been there back in 05. Amazingly, at the end of our conversation, he began an animated conversation with his translator. At the end of it, Thupten Jinpa, who's his translator, said to me, he said, Jim, His Holiness so believes in what you're doing, he wants to make a personal donation. He gave the largest donation he's ever given to a non-Tibetan cause to the founding of the center. So it was really quite extraordinary. Now, it's interesting, people talk about Darwin, and oftentimes you hear people say it's survival of the fittest and survival of the most ruthless. And in fact, Darwin really never said that. That was a distortion of what he wrote, actually by an economist. And I'm sure that's not surprising to you. It could have been a hedge fund manager or a banker, right? So Darwin argued that sympathy, and in this actually instance he's actually talking about compassion, will have been increased with natural selection for those communities which included the greatest number of the most sympathetic members would flourish best and rear the greatest number of offspring. And he was right. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. You know, it's interesting, if you look at our evolution, or the evolution of the mammalian species, which at least in theory, some people would argue we're the highest of that evolution. Some might argue differently. But as we evolved and we became the human species, the cost for having, if you will, theory of mind or the ability to perceive another and sit in that person's shoes, if you will, or to have abstract thinking or to have language came at a cost. And that cost was, as we see the species evolve, a smaller litter size and the requirement that the offspring were taken care of for years and years and years outside the womb. It's not as if a child is born and just runs away off into the forest. There's an absolute requirement. Yet, what would connect the parent to that child, or specifically the mother to that child, unless there had evolved these very, very sophisticated and deep-rooted nurturing bonds? Because otherwise, there's little return from all the energy expended to raise that child. And you could argue that we actually have evolved to nurture. So if we look at the biology of nurturing, one example of these hormones or bonding mechanisms that have occurred is with this oxytocin. Some call it the love hormone, some call it the nurturing hormone, some call it the bonding hormone. This has been key to the development of the nurturing mechanism between a mother and a child. And His Holiness has said, and many people have said, that's one of the strongest bonds between a mother and a child. It stops a mother from abandoning her child. It actually puts the mother at risk sometimes to save her child. And while there are others, this one is particularly strong. And what's interesting is it was found that there was a species of voles. In that particular instance, the voles remained monogamous. They took co-parented. Yet there's another species of voles that the males are philanders and bigamous. And it turns out that the difference was their levels of this oxytocin, and that the ones who were the philanderers had a very low level compared to those that did the co-parenting. And so it shows you that there's some deep mechanisms here associated with this sense of bonding and caring. Here's some examples, which I'll talk about a little bit more, of this powerful nurturing mechanism. As an example, the absence of nurturing leads to poor attachment. Additionally, our nervous system is attuned to responding to the emotions and the feelings of other people. We have evolved for that. And also, an interesting study that was done that showed what is the highest value when individuals are seeking a mate. And then we'll talk about this issue of passivism by my colleague at Stanford, Dr. Sapolsky in regard to primates. So if you look at some of the findings associated with poor bonding or lack of nurturing, look at what we can see are health conditions when somebody has not grown up in a place as a child where they were appropriately nurtured. Look at the cost of that. And you can see the levels of anxiety, depression, alcoholism, and substance abuse simply associated with poor attachment. I talked briefly about the system of being attuned to others' actions or feelings or emotions, and this is what we call the mirror neuron system, which many of you have heard about, where we can put ourselves in the position of another and feel their emotions. We can look at another person. In many ways, that's how we learn emotion. And then I mentioned this study by Buss in 1986, where they asked first what their highest value in a mate, and as you can imagine, beauty, external beauty, rated high up there for men. And of course, for women, it wasn't external beauty, was it? It was financial prospects were the one for women. But ranking far above either of those was that they had a partner who exhibited attributes of kindness and caring. I don't know if any of you have seen this book by Dr. Sapolsky, but it's interesting that he has found, and others have found, that in certain primates, it is not the ones who are the most combative and who are the most ruthless that survives. It is the ones that are most cooperative and caring for the group within the tribe, if you will. And in fact, he gives an example of two alpha males, the one and the two, fighting for dominance of a group. What happens is the number three male goes around and has sex with all the females while the other two are fighting. So it tells you the advantage, perhaps, of not being quite as aggressive, I suppose. Here's an instance, again, talking about oxytocin, where we see that the receptor gene associated with oxytocin is associated with more prosocial behavior and cooperative tendencies, the GG oxytocin, but the other combination is actually associated with significantly less prosocial behavior. So clearly there is a genetic basis, if you will, for individuals sometimes being compassionate. Now this, and we also know through studies on sociopaths, that we can now predict at a young age, in fact, children who may become sociopaths, and also we're seeing brain abnormalities in those individuals. Now this would beg the question, are those individuals really responsible for their actions if in fact they're born with a deficit that doesn't allow them to connect or respond to human emotion? Would you punish a person who was born without legs because they cannot walk? And this is a whole other ethical issue that we will be coping with as we learn more about these genetic variations that, on the one hand, may create individuals like His Holiness the Dalai Lama or Desmond Tutu, individuals who are naturally compassionate, but also creates people like the Jeffrey Dahmers and other individuals who've demonstrated such horrible sociopathic behavior. The other interesting thing is that people who have chronic loneliness have an overexpression of actually, if you will, immune cells causing an excessive inflammatory response. And what we know is that certain types of mental practices, and we'll talk about this a little bit, such as mindfulness, meditation, actually will boost your immune system, and it will also, of course, make you open to others, perhaps. But when you have nothing like that, you see the effects of that. So what is compassion? It's feeling moved by another's suffering. It's recognizing that the other's suffering is not a threat or a challenge to you. Because what happens is when you see another suffering, you have to process this, right? You have to sit there and say, well, this person is at risk. They're suffering. If I engage, am I going to be hurt? Is it going to cost me something? And you have to decide to engage, which is the helping component. And then this then kicks in, if you will, this nurturing and affiliative system.
and this recognition that the other is like you, and then ultimately this desire to intervene leads to this positive effect, and we'll talk about that a little bit more. And here are the neuroanatomic constructs of this response. So the first thing that has to happen again is you have this very primitive part of your brain which responds to threat and determines if you're fearful or anxious about something. So then you have to say, this person is not a threat to me. And then you have to sit there and then say, then I will be empathetic. I will take on their suffering. And then this, once you have identified them as like you and taken on the suffering, then your affiliative pathways kick in. And then there's this concept of common humanity where you see yourself as them. And then this activates your reward centers or your pleasure centers. And in fact, this is a big driver, ultimately, of compassionate behavior, because, and this is where that earlier quote where it said, if you want to make yourself happy, be compassionate, or if you want to make others happy, be compassionate. If you want to make yourself happy, be compassionate. Because when you are compassionate, it kicks in the system. And in fact, it has been found in certain instances where somebody is caring for another or giving to another, that in fact the metabolism in these areas are greater than if they're having an orgasm. Now, I'm not sure if that's been my personal experience, but there are some studies that support that. So we're going to talk a little bit about contemplative science and brain function. So let's look at some of the practices that have led to this interest in contemplative neuroscience. Of course, I think almost everyone in here aware of mindfulness and the mindfulness stress-based stress reduction pioneered by John Kabat-Zinn. A number of studies have been done on that now. And again, we look at effect in regard to stress and chronic pain and improved immune response. And actually, it decreases your markers for stress. And we'll talk about why in a little bit. One of the ways that occurs is in our modern society, we are inundated with information, data, processing things. Yet the reality is that our genetic structure, our DNA, has not changed for over 200,000 years. We were not meant to live in this society we live in today. And in fact, if you look at how evolution works, it's almost this linear or very slowly sloping things over changes over millions of years, this incremental evolution, but technology is moving like this, right? In fact, it's amazing because 5,000 years ago is only when humans began living in cities. Only 10,000 years ago, the primary survival strategy for humans was what? It was being a hunter-gatherer, living in groups of 10 to 50 people. Well, in that situation and that slow evolution, it makes perfect sense. We went from a situation where it was this nuclear family who stayed together. The threat of the environment and the mean world out there resulted in this evolving hunter-gatherer tribes with small groups of people. You were connected to them. They knew who you were. In many ways, the survival of the group depended on you caring for other people and them caring for you. And in fact, in that situation, they knew all about you. If you were down, if you were upset, if you were unhappy, unless it was dealt with, it put the group at risk. So they were highly attuned to that. And look at our modern society today. You know, there are people who have lived, sat in a cubicle next to somebody for 30 or, you know, for years and know only that person's first name. And that could be, they could think that that's one of their closest people they're connected to. People are terrified of showing their vulnerability to express their pain they're in, yet they're always distracted and have all these other things going on that create this level of stress that at a chronic level is incredibly detrimental. And what happens is we have this still, though, this primitive neuromechanism, this flight or fight response from our amygdala or our reptilian brain, which causes us to respond to threat. Now, if you're on the savannah in Africa, it's a wonderful mechanism. You know, you suddenly get this massive release of epinephrine and norepinephrine. You get these stressor hormones such as cortisol. You run really fast. You climb up a tree. You survive. And then you're right back down to normal. And if you don't survive, it really doesn't matter, right? But in our modern society, for many people, that sympathetic system has been hijacked, and they have this chronic release of these hormones that impede the function of the immune system and also has incredibly deleterious effects over the long haul in regard to mental and physical health and, in fact, in regard to longevity. But the corollary to that, or the opposite of that, though, is the parasympathetic nervous system, which allows actually you to relax, to engage, to be cooperative, and practices such as mindfulness meditation, compassion meditation, actually bring balance to that. And that's why so many of you have benefited from that, because it takes you out of that situation where you're chronically stressed and puts those systems where you're back in balance. And this is mediated through the vagus nerve. And in fact, when Richie Davidson began his studies with monks, and I don't know if you've heard this story, one of the ways they wanted to measure compassion at the time they did the study was placing this EEG cap, which you'll see a picture on, right? It fits over your head with all these electrodes, and it's really quite funny looking. And he's with this group of monks, and he put the cap on, explaining this was how they were going to train compassion. And the monks all started laughing. And he thought they were laughing because it looked funny. And he asked the question of, that, is that the case? And the monk said, no, it's because you don't know where compassion is. Compassion's here. It's not here. And this gets back to this other comment, these other comments that I was making. And here is the effects of this stressor system, or the sympathetic nervous system. You know, it was created for self-preservation, but for many people, there's this increased vigilance to threat. And as a result, you can see the hidden effects over here of chronically engaging your sympathetic nervous system. And you can also see how when your sympathetic nervous system engaged, not only is your amygdala engaged, but it also affects what we call your executive control functions in your frontal lobe. And that's where you have moral reasoning, that's where you have certain types of decision making, and it impairs that function for you to make good decisions. And here is what that cap looks like, and here's one of the tools that we use for measuring brain metabolism, and this is for monitoring electrical activity of the brain. And I'll just show you this study real quick. So there are two concepts, this concept of compassion carryover, and without getting too boring here, what happened is individuals were shown these sort of abstract pictures, and then they asked people to say how they felt about them, what type of response, but what they did was they included a subliminal picture of either somebody smiling or having a neutral expression. And if they had a smiling or concerned expression or engaging expression, the people felt that the art was much better than it really was. So it shows you that actually on a subconscious level, we see things that we don't appreciate. And when you were talking about yourself and response to emotion, many people don't know that we are actually geared for understanding micro movements in the face and around the eyes and even just body posture to judge how people are reacting to us. Like some of you are getting very bored. So I sense that. So this is actually proof of this system that we have, which actually, even unconscious to us, responds to people or situations where people are being more positive. The other interesting thing is some studies have been done by a colleague of mine, and in this instance, individuals are given an option of, they're given some money, they're students, and we use students quite liberally. They're given money, and then they have choices. And sometimes they can just buy something. Other times they can choose to give. And then other times we take the money and give to a charitable cause. And amazingly, whether they choose to give the money or we take it from them and give it for a good cause, both result and the pleasure centers of their brain responding. So isn't that interesting? When they are forced to give, they still get the benefit. This is a study, and I can't see it very well, and I'm not sure why, but anyway, it shows an individual receiving pain, and then it is a study whereby the spouse responds to that individual, and she's quite empathetic to her partner being potentially injured here, and it shows how this connection of somebody who, if you will, is in your in-group or who you care about, how you respond to them. So the more empathetic or the more you identify with somebody, the more likely you are to respond to them. Now, here's another interesting study out of Italy. And this is a different situation. And I know it may be a little hard to see, but this is a study where they had groups of people, and people were asked how they responded to people. One group was a group who received AIDS from IV drug abuse. One group was a group who had gotten AIDS through blood transfusion through no fault of their own. And people were significantly more critical or less sympathetic to their situation if they felt they were IV drug abusers or potentially used, were the cause of their own problem versus somebody receiving this illness through no fault of their own. And this brings up an interesting point of this in-group and outer group. You know, we talked about the oxytocin hormone, right? This bonding hormone. And then we talked about these small groups of hunter-gatherers that we used to, these groups we used to live in. Well, our evolution has actually created a situation, though, where we still have tendencies to decide what is an in-group for us. And typically, what is your in-group? It's people who look like you. It's oftentimes people who maybe go to the same church. It's oftentimes people have the same habits as you. Have you ever noticed outside in a place where outside the door of your office building, there's a small group of people who huddle and smoke, right? They all hang out and talk together. So we have this tendency to define in-groups, and that means there is an out-group. And what happens is this is really one of the biggest challenges to be compassionate, is how to extend your in-group, and this is one of the things we're going to talk about. And in fact, it's interesting, if you give intranasal oxytocin to someone, what happens? They feel this intense desire to hug you and care for you and get close to you, to everyone who is in their in-group. But if it's somebody they define as their out-group based on, let's say, race, culture, ethnicity, religion, that has no effect. This is one of the problems we have, isn't it? How can our species survive if we have this tendency to say my in-group? Because remember, these were created to protect us from evils or a hostile environment. Yet we have to recognize that all of humanity is us, right? That should be the in-group. And our home isn't just where we live, it's the earth. But how do we embrace this and recognize this responsibility and have this very deep desire to care for others as if they were our child? And this is going to be the issue that will ultimately define our humanity and whether our species will survive. We know that with certain types of practices, and here's my friend Matthieu Ricard, we can actually train the brain. Matthieu has done, I think, 30,000 hours of compassion meditation. I mean, he's extraordinary. In fact, if you ask him, and we talked about these different areas of the brain that light up as these different behaviors occur, you can actually monitor them, and you can actually, if you will, let's say if you're taking on the suffering of another, you're feeling their pain, Matthieu can actually say, I want you 30% to be empathetic, and he can actually modulate that. He can increase his it dramatically, to the point where he will tell you he is in so much pain from taking on the suffering of another that he's about to cry. But it shows you that with mental training, you can actually have immense regulation of how you process information, how you respond to information. And in fact, if you look at these high amplitude gamma waves where there's both diffuse activity and it's cross hemispheric, only people who've done deep meditation and profound exercising of their brain are able to do this. But here's what these trainings can do. As an example, with a loving kindness meditation, you see marked increase in positive emotion and less depression. Well, that certainly makes sense. You know, the challenge many of us have is if we think about what happens when you become depressed, you go inward, don't you? You get self-absorbed, you ruminate. When you're having loving kindness meditation, it's an outward look at people. We have this desire to give them love. And again, naturally, if you see an individual who by their very nature reaches out to you and has this open heart to you, most people respond by connecting with them. And then, of course, we know that these types of exercises strengthen attention and increase telomere length, which is associated with increase in longevity. It's interesting, there was a study done on volunteerism, which in some ways is like a form of compassion, isn't it? You're caring for others. So this was a group of individuals over the age of 65. And what they did was they measured their volunteer hours in the community. And those people who volunteered above a minimal level had significantly increased longevity compared to those who didn't, with one exception. In the surveys, if the people said that they were doing the volunteering to impress a friend, so if it was not authentic caring, they did not reap the benefit of actually being compassionate. So it's really about authenticity. So we talked about a little bit of this in these areas of the brain that light up. Here is an experiment. The red is the people like Mathieu, and the blue are people who are probably like us, or maybe not like us, but people who are not trained in any type of meditation, let's say. So it's probably not us. But what they did was they had these people under the MRI, and then they exhibited a pain response or a loud noise of distress, like somebody in pain. And the meditators, even though they were in a state of meditation while the others were asked to concentrate, they were clearly responding to people, and their minds were still engaged, even though they were in deep meditation, while people who were just asked to be calm really did not have any significant type of response. And then this is a study we did at Stanford using our compassion cultivation training, and it was where we had different groups, where we had a compassion meditation group, we had a mindfulness meditation group, we had improvisational theater, and then we had no training. And these individuals were then asked to respond to letters from criminals and before and after. And these were created letters which had certain words in them and a certain number, and there's a way to do this. And then before the training, they wrote letters to the criminals to say, you know, this person's in prison, he's been convicted of murder, you know, would you write a letter to him just giving your thoughts versus afterwards. And the people who underwent this compassion type meditation, they did not, you know, condone what this person did, but the way they looked at the person in the sense that they showed a caring for them, they didn't forgive them of this act, they didn't say everything's going to be just fine, they were encouraging, and they gave a much more positive outlook than any of the other groups. This is another study that is based on the compassion cultivation training at Stanford. And again, these individuals demonstrated a much greater willingness to help others. And a key here is they were much more compassionate to themselves. Here's another study, not done by us, but my colleague, Dr. Pace and Raison. This is one of the first studies that compared stress hormones and passion meditation. And there was a significant decrease in those markers for immune function and as well as a lowering of baseline cortisol levels. We know that, as I mentioned earlier, these reward centers, which respond, and although this is a more new component of our evolution, money, but to food and sex are the same areas that respond when we feel compassionate or caring for others. And again, this actually, that same slide about the study where these same centers lit up when individuals actually were forced to give to charity. And in fact, the more they were forced to give, the higher response they had in terms of their sense of reward or pleasure. This reemphasizes that previous slide I showed about where they showed a subliminal presentation and how there was this compassion carryover, if you will. And then these are some interesting studies that we've begun where one of the things that's interested me is the evolution of nurturing through mammalian species. And what we're doing here, although this, I will tell you, this was not with funds from the Dalai Lama, because I got immense numbers of letters about putting fiber optic cables into rats' brains. It turns out that there's a technique called optogenetics, whereby we can actually select a set of genes, very specifically, and then implant new genes, the same genes, but with chemoreceptors that, in the face of certain wavelengths of light, will turn on and off the gene. And we're trying to define, or if you will, deconstruct these nurturing pathways, and then to see how they changed over evolution. As an example, without getting into too much detail, what we did was, and I say we, this is the Imperial we, I did not do this. So we took out this set of genes, which was one of the nurturing genes, dopaminergic, in the context of a female and who had a litter. If we turned on the wavelength of light to turn off her nurturing gene and separated her pups, she would take an immense long period of time and, in fact, ignore some of them before picking them up. If we turned on that gene, she would immediately go and pick them up. The other interesting thing is if we introduced a foreign male into a male's box, it had a profound effect. Normally, the male would defend its territory, right? But if we turn on his nurturing gene, instead of showing aggressive behavior, he starts sniffing the other male's butt, and which apparently is a socialization thing for some species. Shows you, though, as much as we think in some ways that we are products of our training, of our environment, in some ways the reality, though, is we are all also limited by our genetic potential, which I'll talk about in a minute. Other things that we do at SeekCare, we actually work with Phil Zimbardo, and we actually do interventions, in fact, some types of compassion training with gang members, and had some wonderful results with that. And we also do some implanted electrodes, actually, in humans who have seizure disorders to understand different areas of when we present different scenarios to them, how they respond in terms of compassion, to better define some of these neural pathways. So some of the things we know is that happiness, compassion, is that all of us have a thermostat when we're born. And, you know, we talked about sociopaths. If we look at almost everything, it's in a bell-shaped curve. So over here, the sociopaths, most of us are here in the middle. And then you have people like the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu who are way over here, and the different saints and others. But we do know within this range, probably all of us are not at our maximal potential in terms of being compassionate, caring for others. Now, why is that important? It's important, obviously, for other people because you care for them, right? And a person in need, obviously, when they're cared for, they benefit. But the benefit to you in terms of how you feel about yourself, you know, we talked about these rich people as an example who they keep acquiring things, but these are things that give them no sustenance. We know that, if you will, as a species, we have a desire for transcendence. And what does that mean? Almost every human, if you ask them, will sit there and say, I want my life to be meaningful. I want my life to have had a purpose. And when they connect with other people, you become more than the sum of two people. When you recognize that you're all connected, you have immense power. And, you know, this idea of having purpose, knowing that you're here for a reason, this is what defines our humanity and makes us have this great sense of joy in our hearts. And through practices such as types of mindfulness meditation, compassion cultivation training, you can potentiate those feelings, and also reap the health benefit in terms of a longer life, higher levels of happiness, decreased stress hormones, and improved immune function. It even extends into cardiac function. In fact, one of the greatest causes of sudden cardiac death is something we call lack of heart rate variability, which is a manifestation of chronically increased sympathetic tone. And by improving your parasympathetic tone, it actually increases your heart rate variability and improves your cardiac health. The other thing we talked about is, again, compassion decreases stress by regulating your autonomic nervous system and increasing the tone of the parasympathetic nervous system. We talked about this sense of common humanity, expanding your in-group. And, of course, in the West, one of the greatest challenges we have as human beings, and Christine Neff has done an immense amount of work, is being compassionate to ourselves. It's extraordinary how, in the West, we have a tendency to beat ourselves up and be hypercritical, when in fact, most of us are kind people. Most of us are trying to do the best we can. We may not have the tools, we may not have the life experience to put us in the best position, but most of us are just human beings who are struggling. And you know, it's interesting, when I give these talks, and sometimes they can be quite powerful in the sense that people will tear up, and that almost always happens, though. Because what happens when you're in a room, we talked about, you know, when you're a small tribe, you can't hide. You can't hide your vulnerability. In large groups of people, especially in modern society, what do we run around and do? We try and sit there and present and project to people that we're not in pain, that we're not suffering, that we have our acts together, and that we're independent and don't need anybody. And as soon as you do that, you're separated from somebody. Yet, if I sit there and tell you a story and I say, you know, it really hurt me, this experience, I'm in pain, what happens to you immediately? You want to connect, don't you? This is what we're meant for. And if we can let our guard down to understand that every person wants that same thing. Every person wants to be loved. Every person wants to be hugged. And every person is just as frightened as you are. It's when you come to that conclusion, when you keep your heart open, when you recognize that almost no one is different than you. They all want the same things. They want a happy life. They want to be cared for. They want to be loved. When you give that gift to people, you're loved in return. Are there any questions? Well, you know, in healthcare workers, you know, there's, they call it compassion fatigue, but it's usually emotional, being empathy excess, if you will. And that can be very detrimental to your health. The other aspect is, when you say you're being overly compassionate, though, I'm not sure what that means. If in the context of a healthcare worker, in the context where you always feel like you're putting yourself out there and you're not putting boundaries on your behavior, yes, it can be extraordinarily detrimental because you get lost in that emotion and you're not having self-care. And in fact, the training program we have at Stanford, which is called the Compassion Cultivation Training, it starts out first by teaching people certain tools in mindfulness so you can get attention and non-judgmental self-awareness. And then it talks about this idea of self-compassion, caring for yourself and recognizing that you're in pain and not letting that get lost. Because what happens to some people, they're in so much pain too, that they think that by keep going out there to help others, it's going to relieve their pain because they're being really good people. But until you face your own pain, you carry that burden. I'll give you a really quick example. I had a woman come to me about back pain, and as a neurosurgeon, my office is filled with this all day long. But this particular woman, she had a small abnormality. She was in her 20s. She had a small abnormality on her x-ray or her MRI. And it was obvious, though, that wasn't the problem. This woman was in deep pain, back pain, abdominal pain, and it had been going on since she was a young girl. And she was overweight. She was sort of slovenly dressed. She had bangs across her eyes. She looked at her wrists if somebody took the time to look. She tried to slit her wrists. So, you know, even though I'm a neurosurgeon, I spent a fair amount of time with her because there's got to be a driver, right? For all of us have drivers for why we act the way we do. And in her instance,
I'd spend enough time with her where the underlying cause of her pain wasn't her back. This poor girl had been molested by her father, her stepfather, when she was 12. And she had been carrying this pain that no one, you know, took the time to understand. I give a talk sometimes, and it says, you know, science and technology are wonderful things. You know, they can cure an immense amount of ills. But the risks to our humanity are what I call wounds of the heart. You know, all of us in our lives have our hearts injured. And for most of us, those injuries heal. But some, they're very, very deep. And until you get at the core of them and the pain that they're causing, because, you know, when we look at war, when we look at global warming, when we look at ecological destruction, when we look at all these negative behaviors, these are not external problems. These are problems of the human heart. And science and technology are not going to solve them, at least the way we're doing it, until we direct all of our sophistication at these problems of the heart, we're going to be doomed as a species.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.